Are in fellowship and continue on here. We are now ready to begin with Mark chapter 5, continuing, of course, the narrative from the previous chapter, describing their final destination here on the Sea of Galilee as they were headed across from Capernaum to the east side. And in 5:1, they came to the other side of the sea, into the country of the Gerasenes. And as a chi here that's not translated, they came is the present, or pardon me, the aorist active indicative of Erchomai. And the they in this case would not only be limited to Jesus and his disciples there, but the other boats that were with them. There's no indication that they ever parted company. Into the other side, literally, directional preposition ice, plus the adverb with the definite article peran, P-E-R-A-N, which means the 10 times that phrase is used there, that with a definite article, and it means the other side, literally. The other side of the sea, he thalassa, the genitive feminine singular, of the Sea of Galilee. Into the region or district, again, directional preposition ice plus this word, chora, C-H-O-R-A. First, the word means dry land as opposed to sea. So it can come to mean an area of dry land, hence a region or a district. The first thing that stands out about this word is it is not specific. It is not fixing a point for you. It is fixing an area. And so that is important because people want to make issues here. We do have some textual issues that have to be addressed here in verse 1, and they revolve around this term, Gerasenos. G-E-R-A-S-E-N-O-S. Transliterated almost over into the English, Gerasenes. There's three variant readings. Matthew has Gadarenes, Luke has Gerasenes, and Mark here has the region of the Gerasenes. So we acknowledge that Matthew records a different word, and there is a reason why, as we will see. If you've got your map there, that primary map I sent out to use for the study of Mark, or if you don't have that, you can look in your Bible, you can probably find it. It might be on there, it might not. I can't remember if my Bible had the maps that had that on it or not. But I don't know that my Bible maps do. But at any rate, if you look there, on the map that I handed out, there's a place that they have a question mark by called Gergesa, which is right there on the northeast corner of the Sea of Galilee. But then a little further to the south, you see Gadara. And actually, Gergesa was further inland than what it's shown on that map. And Gadara is about rightly located. It is south. And then if you go even further south and east, you'll see a city called Gerasa. And that's way off the Sea of Galilee. So this, one of the things you might expect as the liberal interpreters begin to attack the veracity of the text, they say this is impossible. This could not have happened because first Gadara, the Gadarenes, and the Gerasenes, quote, those people that resided in and around those cities, they're not on the Sea of Galilee, so therefore the Bible's inaccurate. That's their first attack. That is, in fact, the knee-jerk response when they run into these difficult things. But we will deal with this more in the exposition. So just to point out to you that this is an issue textually. And one of the problems becomes is they try to harmonize these Gospels. When they run into these problems, well-meaning, no doubt, well-meaning scribes, when they were translating these or when they were copying them, would say, oh, well, I remember I read Matthew's version and it had Gadarene, so that needs to be changed here. And so they would change the text, thinking they were doing people a favor. Again, one of the things we pointed out when you deal with the issue of translation and of scribery even, as they just copied books over and over again, is that all you want, you don't want a person that thinks very much. You want somebody who will just write what's there. That's really all you want. So, again, they try to harmonize these things, and then it just creates more problems. And while they were well-meaning, it didn't help. So when he got out of the boat, immediately a man from the tombs with an unclean spirit met him. And as Kai, again here not translated, having gotten out of the boat, or having gone out, exerchomai, the verb, E-X-E-R-C-H-O-M-A-I, having gone out or departed, him is Jesus, and you actually have here, this is a genitive absolute clause, the genitive, the participle there, the aorist active participle is in the genitive case, as is the noun. And again, a genitive absolute clause just means that it's designed to provide you additional information that's not, quote, directly related to the sentence structure. So here you have this genitive chain. But when he had gotten out from the boat, again, that's also act with the ablative of ploion, immediately, Mark's one of his favorite words, euthus. Immediately a man from the tombs met him. You've actually got the verb here now in the Greek, hupantao, H-U-P-A-N-T-A-O. H-U-P is what that's supposed to be. And that word means 10 times. It means to meet, to encounter someone. The encounter can be friendly or hostile depending upon context. In this case, it's a hostile encounter, as we will see, because there's a spiritual hostility that exists. And so we are dealing here with Jesus confronting a demon-possessed guy. And so immediately a man with an unclean spirit met him. Him is Jesus, autos, a man from the tombs. Preposition ek here, again, with the ablative of mene amaya, M-N-E-M-E-I-O-N. This word comes from the verb mene menuo. Mene menuo means to remember something, to call something to mind. And so this is something, a token of remembrance. Hence a tomb or a grave, a monument or a memorial. So from the tombs, a man... Anthropos in the Anarthrous, no definite article here. A man with an unclean spirit. Preposition in here, probably to be understood, used here in an instrumental sense. And then the instrumental of pneuma with akathartas. P-N-E-U-M-A, which is the word for spirit. And then akathartas, a.k.a. T-H-A-R-T-O-S. That means unclean. And the unclean spirits, of course, are demons. These are fallen angels who have not been imprisoned. We have two categories of fallen angels. One has been imprisoned in the bowels of the earth in Tartarus. That group was there because of their infiltration in the Genesis 6 episode. But that was a small segment of the demons. That's not the majority of them. The majority of them are still free. To roam around. And one of the things that we're going to see here in this is apparently Satan is not short on forces. We don't know how many angels and demons that there are. Some have speculated that God created as many angelic creatures as he did stars. This is based on the fact that the term stars can be used interchangeably for the term angels. One, we don't have any direct biblical proof of that, but if that is true, when one goes out, say, and looks at the sky late at night, if you go out inland where you can see and not distracted by light, you see what appears to be a multitude, I mean, an incountable number of stars. And so some have suggested that that's how many angels there are. Well, we don't know. What we do know is that the demons are outnumbered by a factor of 2 to 1. And they're outnumbered slightly by more than that because there's a segment of the demons that are in confines. That's recorded, say, in the book of 2 Peter and the book of Jude. Jude 6, for instance, is the reference in Jude. And angels who did not keep their own domain. Literally, did not remain masters of their domain. But abandoned their proper abode. He is kept under eternal bonds under darkness for the judgment of the great day. Why? Because these angels, all angels are by definition masculine. God didn't create any female angels. And angels aren't little cherubs. They aren't little babies floating around with, you know, whatever. They're not females and they're not babies. They're full grown, as it were, masculine creatures. And as a part of their proper domain, they had to remain sexually celibate. Now, because they're celibate doesn't mean they're not endowed with sexual capabilities. If they're male, we would assume they had all the normal male sexual capabilities. But the fact is, part of their deal is that they're not to use them. Well, easy enough when there's nothing but male angels around. You know, at least you'd think. But given our culture, you know, obviously we don't know. But obviously that wouldn't be a problem prior to the fall. But after the fall, apparently as a part of Satan's perverted genius, in order to attack true humanity and in order to prevent the seed of the woman from ever coming and defeating him, there was an attack on true humanity. And it appears that the attack was quite successful. That the infiltration was very deep-seated and very successful. And the implication is only Noah and his family were spared from it at some level. All other families of the earth had been touched by it. So how many, again, there were, we don't know. We know that some of them are in chains, under darkness, waiting for their judgment. And that group gets let out, as we know, in Daniel's 70th week. And when they come out, they're not happy. Well, you can imagine, I mean, the flood is circa 2300 B.C., so assuming this all happened around 2300 B.C., they've been under chains of darkness for like 2300 years. They're probably not happy. And when they come out, they're going to express a great deal of displeasure with the human race. They got a grudge. Okay, well, point one here. Having completed an extremely long day of teaching that had left him exhausted, Jesus Christ and those with him arrive on the east side of the Sea of Galilee. Two, there is no indication that the storm that assailed them caused the trip to take much longer than expected. Therefore, it would appear that late afternoon has now turned to dusk or possibly early evening. It's hard to fix a real time here because you have various factors that we really can't know. It would seem that, you know, late summer, early autumn is sort of the time frame, but again, it's hard to be real dogmatic about that. And as such, you know, you would expect with the changing of the seasons and various factors that this sea, this storm, could easily have come up during that time. Also, we don't know because we don't know what time of the month it even is. I mean, like last night, I woke up about, oh, I don't know, it was like 3 in the morning. And I thought, boy, it must be close to daylight because it seemed pretty bright outside. Well, it wasn't close to daylight, so I went back to bed. But it was still pretty bright outside because it was a full moon, or still the better part of a full moon. I think the full moon is exactly totally past, but it was still pretty bright out. And clearly, if you're on a lake setting where you're not dealing with a lot of things in the way, I mean, the shoreline is noticeably, typically free of timber and this kind of thing. Then if it's a full moon, even if it's just turned dark, you could still probably see pretty well. And as we're going to see, there was another situation. I don't know if it's in Mark. I can't remember right now. But there was another situation where apparently there was a full moon because Jesus is sitting up on a mountain watching the disciples out on the lake struggling. And he can apparently see them pretty clearly and from some distance. So exactly how dark it is and all, it's hard to be really dogmatic about that. But again, by my calculations, I don't think this trip would have taken much more than an hour. Maybe it took two. But it hard to say, but again, we have various factors. We don't know how far they traveled. We don't know how long they made it with the favorable wind. We don't know when the storm hit. But again, the implication is that the storm just rose up very quickly and was gone just as quickly. So all of that may have taken only 15, 20 minutes. I mean, we're really not told. So doing the best I could do with this, I figured it's still basically about evening time. And it could have been still daylight enough to see out. We're just not told. So three, although some have Jesus Christ and his disciples arriving very late at night, I've seen some people that have this trip taken 6 to 8 hours. I don't buy that at all. I mean, these guys would have had to be the worst fishermen in the world if it took them 8 hours to travel, say, 5 miles. They would have had to be really poor. Or either their boat was in horrible condition, but kind of the implication that I get from studying even just Mark is that Peter and James and John and Andrew were fairly well-to-do fishermen and that they had a pretty extensive business. So this would lead me to believe, knowing what I know of fishermen now, that the more successful ones have the newer equipment. I mean, whatever the technology advances may have been in that day, they would have been minimal, we know. But I would assume that they had, you know, that they had their boat and they kept it in pretty much ship shape. Because they know their livelihood depends on that. So, again, I don't see this, you know, some people have him arriving at like 4 or 5 in the morning, and I don't see that. I mean, by then, everybody would have been asleep, you would think. And Jesus was certainly exhausted, we know. So, again, although some have him arriving very late at night or early in the morning, the timing for such a conclusion does not seem to fit the distance traveled or the information we possess. First, the Jews had a period they called the first evening, which is equivalent to our late afternoon. And then they had a later period called the second evening, which occurred after the sun had set. So five, since Mark makes a clear distinction in chapter 1, it seems likely that late afternoon, the first evening is what is in view. And if you look back in Mark chapter 1, and Mark is very explicit in chapter 1, verse 32, where he says, when evening came, after the sun had set. So now he's closely identifying for you which evening is in view. Well, here he doesn't, which leads me to think that it's the earlier of the what the Jews would have called the two evenings. So, six, as Edersheim has noted, it seems most unlikely that multitudes would have resorted to Jesus at Capernaum after the second evening, or that either the disciples or other boats would have put out to sea after nightfall. And that doesn't make sense to me either as well. I don't. Unless Jesus had some overriding consideration about which we're not told. But the implication is he taught and then later in the day sent the disciples out to dismiss the crowds while providing these, you know, private explanations for them as well. And then they loaded up before nightfall and headed out. Six, since the overall trip was something on the order of 5 to 6 miles. And again, we're just guessing because we don't know. We have a good idea, but we don't know precisely where they landed. So it could have been as little as 4 miles. It could have been, let's say, as much as 6, with 5 being sort of a good average. And even allowing for the storm delay, with 4 men rowing, this would take less than an hour. And I say easily, it wouldn't be easily. It would have probably taken them right at an hour, maybe a touch over. So, but again, we're talking about, you know, an hour as opposed to 6 or 8 hours. Okay, let's say we even have to double that and make it 2 hours. Okay, they still arrive not long after they would have probably intended to, assuming you double it even. So, eight, and plus, again, we have other factors that we don't know. Like, what if they made 2/3 of the trip under sail and were doing, you know, a real good speed? 5 or 6 knots. Well, then, you know, a knot's about 1.15 miles an hour, 6 knots. They would have made that trip in about 40 minutes if they, you know, if they had that kind of speed goal. I mean, we don't know. Eight, given the circumstances that had transpired, other disciples may well have decided to aid in the rowing. I think I would have wanted something to do after that myself. I mean, you're sitting there, you're feeling pretty uncomfortable, I would assume. Now, we're not told if Jesus went back under there and went back to sleep. They were probably praying that he would. But if he didn't, you know, they're up there whispering among themselves, who is this guy? What do you think of this? They sure didn't want Jesus to hear them talking about it. And so whatever happened, we don't know. But I think most likely, given their shaken state, they would have wanted to get off of that sea as soon as possible. That they would just wanted to get to the other side. I mean, if you've ever been out, I had an excursion I like to call the Peace River experience. And I know one thing was for sure. By the end of it, all I wanted was off that river. I didn't care. It didn't make any difference. I just wanted out. And I was doing everything I could to get out. I paddled as fast as I could to get down that river. Because God had, well, let's just say, jammed me. And so I was taught a very important lesson. Don't be mean to your wife and go out on the water. What can go wrong now? So, I still remember it. And of course, this was, God, that's been probably, what, 15 years ago or more? Some lessons stick. The ones that really hurt stick. And by the end of this thing, I was miserable, wet, cold, snapped my fishing pole, had gotten sunscreen in my eyes with my contacts. Oh, that's a treat to get sunscreen in your eyes. And you're wearing contacts. And I was just like blinded by the time it was over, and I thought, just get me home. I don't even care anymore. And I got to believe, given their emotional state and their fatigue, they probably wanted to get off that sea pretty quick. So it may be that everybody said, grab an oar, let's go. I mean, we don't know. We're not really told. So, again, given the circumstances, we would assume they wanted to just get off. So 9, therefore Jesus Christ and his very shaken disciples arrive on the eastern shore of the Sea of Galilee, somewhere around sunset, when this very ominous scene unfolds for them. And again, make it just about nightfall and you got it even scarier. I mean, if it's not broad light, it's going to be weird enough even if it's broad daylight. But I mean, you're getting to here and you're coming into a region where that's, you like going walking through the graveyards at night? Anybody really up for that? I mean, most people think, nah, not a place I want to go. And yet, that's where they land. It was right near these graveyards. That much we do know. So, this ominous scene unfolds. And I attend the textual problem with verse 1, which has been addressed at length by anyone seeking to interpret this book, revolves around the names that are given in the gospel accounts. 11, all three synoptic gospels indicate that they are referring to a general region rather than a specific location. This is seen in the use of the noun kora, district or region, which refers to a tract of land inhabited by a particular ethnic or political group. And Matthew calls it the region of the Gadarenes. And again, I believe that is recorded in Matthew 8. I didn't jot down the verse here. Matthew 8, 28. And he uses the same term, kora. And it came when he was come to the other side into the country or region of the Gergesenes. As... There's a textual issue in Matthew, though. Some have Gadarenes, some have Gergesenes. There met him two men possessed by devils. That's another important point. Mark only records one, Matthew records two. So what are we to conclude? Well, I think there were two. I think that Mark only focuses on the primary one. Because even in that group of demon-possessed guys, there was a recognized leader. And it was the one Mark focuses on. And he was the recognized leader, as we're going to see, for a reason. And then also Luke 8 is the parallel in Luke. He also uses the word kora in verse 26. They sailed to the country of the Gerasenes, which is opposite Galilee. And all that tells you is it's on the east side of the lake as opposed to the west. I mean, the opposite Galilee thing doesn't tell you a whole bunch. But it's on the other side. So Matthew calls it the region of the Gadarenes, while Mark and Luke refer to it as the region of the Gerasenes. I mean, the best textual issue in Matthew has Gadarenes. So 13, the country of the Gerasenes was located on the east side of the Sea of Galilee, in the region that was within the Decapolis, and reached almost to the Dead Sea on the south. Now, Decapolis is called that, by the way, you can probably figure it out, but if not, the word polis means city, and deca means 10. We get our word decimal from that, in fact. So it was a region of 10 cities. And it was largely, while located within the strict confines of Israel, it became more the home of non-Israelites, although there were Israelites that lived among them. But it was a region that was inhabited by Gentiles more regularly than, say, other parts of Israel, like Galilee and certainly Judea. But, of course, that's not to say there weren't Gentiles in Galilee and Judea. They were scattered all around, as we know. Herod, in fact, is a Gentile. He's not strictly Jewish. He's an Edomite. But there's this whole region called the Decapolis, and on the map we've got, you'll see it's recorded twice, right below Gadara and right below Gerasa, because the Decapolis was a very large area. Substantially, again, running from the north of the Sea of Galilee all the way to the south, almost to the Dead Sea. So the capital, point 12, was Gadara, but the most populous city was Gerasa. Therefore, Matthew refers to the region by the name of the capital, while the other authors refer to it by the most prominent city. Well, that's not unusual. I mean, what's the capital of New York? Quick. Albany. Albany, there you go. What's the most famous part of New York? Not Albany. Most people don't think of Albany when they think of New York. So, we have the same kind of thing that goes on in our culture pretty regularly. The capital city is often not the most notable city. And the same thing was true in that region. So for one to refer to it by the region of the Gerasenes and one by the Gadarenes isn't really a big deal. Because one of them's referring to the capital and one's referring to the most prominent city. So that erases, to my thinking, that erases a lot of the issues right there, if you just understand that. So 15, however, it should be noted that neither place is the actual site of the incident, since Gadara was some 6 miles inland to the southeast of the Sea of Galilee, while Gerasa was some 30 miles further south and east of Gadara. And so because of that, of course, again, many liberals immediately attack us and say, see, this couldn't have happened. Well, first, it didn't say he went to those cities. It said he went to the region that held those cities. And that's obviously far different than saying I went there. So if I say, it'd be tantamount to say, I traveled to the northeast. Or even I traveled to New York. Well, you wouldn't have any idea what part of New York I went to. I mean, there's, you know, everything from Long Island to Manhattan to upper New York State. There, you know, it stands out there quite a ways to the east even. I mean, I could be all over the place. And I could still be honest and accurate by saying I went to New York. So, again, to me, that's not, you know, they make a big deal out of it. To me, it shouldn't be. So 16, this site seems to have been first proposed by Origen, who seems to have introduced an alternate textual problem as he referred to the city of the Gergesenes. So he introduces a new problem into the mix besides the textual issues we already have. And because Origen is viewed as one of the early church fathers that was reputable, people often give his stuff sometimes more credibility than it deserves. And so that just adds, in this case, fuel to the fire. Well, 17, the only place that aligns with the evidence we are presented in the Bible is a city called Gergesa. Now that, to me, is why probably Origen introduced this. But it's known in modern times as Cursa, K-H-E-R-S-A, or Cursa. And some even have it as Cursi, K-E-R-S-I. That's another alternate name for it. And it's essentially close to what on our map is labeled Gergesa, right on the shore there of the Sea of Galilee. And so that seems to be a good candidate for the point, and there's a couple of reasons why. Number one, it fits what we know of the time the trip must have took. If they left in the afternoon, again, we hear nothing about them camping out on the beach at night or making a fire or all the things you would have done. All we hear is that they get out of the boats and boom, there's this guy running at them, this naked guy. And two of them, in fact. Two naked screaming guys running at you. And you've pulled up to the graveyard. Now, are you going to be freaked out? Yes. And plus, pretend you forgot how shaken you were about the sea incident that just occurred. Which may have been no more than a half an hour before that. And maybe, let's say, even an hour. But still, they were still pretty shaken. And then they get here and this confronts them. So they're not having what I would call a good day. Or at least a good evening. So 18, here additionally, there are cliffs in this region that contain both natural and man-made tombs. Now, they're about a mile and up to 2 miles away from the shoreline. But again, assuming it was still daylight or maybe there was a full moon out, there's no reason if you were sitting in an elevated position. And how much noise these guys were making as they approached the shore, I would assume it's the normal amount of noise that a group of 15 to, and then you got, say, 15 in one boat, but you have three or four boats. So as they approach the shore, there's probably going to be a fair amount of noise that one would expect. And so if they're sitting a mile away, maybe, and I don't even think they were probably quite that far, but let's assume they were, and they're sitting up in an elevated position and it's pretty lit. You could see what was going on down there. You could see this happening. So again, there are a large number of natural and man-made tombs with a large number of inscriptions carved into the rocks. 19, as Edersheim notes, the locality entirely meets the requirements of the narrative. And see, Edersheim was just dumb enough to take the Bible seriously rather than try to find some alternate explanation for it. Which I like that. So about a quarter an hour to the south of Gersa, actually, as he called it, which is, again, a lot of times you'll see that in these Semitic languages, a G and a KH will be alternately used, or a K. The hard consonants can be interchanged sometimes. Just as sometimes we'll have like a hard C, it'll almost have the sound of a hard K. So there is a steep bluff which descends abruptly on a narrow ledge of the shore. And he's talking about the event that's going to happen here, but we haven't gotten to that yet. But there was a herd of pig farmers out there, in addition to these other guys. A terrified herd running down this cliff could not have recovered its foothold and must have inevitably been hurled into the lake beneath. Again, the whole country around is burrowed with limestone caverns and rock chambers for the dead, such as those which were the dwelling of the demonized. And altogether, the scene forms a fitting background to the narrative. And I agree with him 100%. It certainly fits everything we know from the timing to get over there to the time of day it was to the location. Because you can't have Jesus and the disciples running inland to Gadara. That does not fit. One, it wouldn't even fit the time frame to get across the lake, because clearly it would be a much longer trip, a double it at least, maybe more, from going to Gergesa there on the east side if they went all the way south towards where the Jordan comes out. And so that, to me, none of that fits. So we have to look for a region in that area that would fit the geography that we know the Bible sets forth. That's because we presume that the Bible is inspired by God and trustworthy. And if this isn't trustworthy, if we can't find a place that fits this, how can we trust our souls to this thing? I mean, the answer is, of course, logically, you couldn't. So 20, the region of the Decapolis, which extended from Damascus in the north to Gadara in the south, was composed of 10 Hellenized cities. Although the list varied from author to author, which 10 cities comprised the Decapolis wasn't necessarily always the same depending upon who you read. And obviously some cities would fall into disfavor and become less popular as a destination, and other cities would rise up. I mean, this is just a part of what happens. So if you go try to figure out, okay, which were the exact 10 of the Decapolis, it kind of depends on who you read. Which had a small Jewish population within them. 21, however, since it was not likely that a Jew would be raising swine. That's the first problem you've got here we're going to have to confront, is there's these pig farmers. And, of course, every good Jew would have known that pigs were off limits. So this would suggest a much more Gentile sort of flavor to this in population. And this would appear to be, from what I've been able to tell, Jesus' first real, what I would call real interaction with Gentiles in his ministry. And there were only a few of them. There really weren't very many. But one of the things we see is that what we're going to find out here is that there is a wholesale rejection of Jesus by these people. They do not think about it. They do not debate on it. They just tell him, get lost. We don't want you here. And this happens really probably the very next day. That after this event, that some time takes for this news to spread a day or so, and that they're out there to meet him to say thanks, but no thanks. Get back in your boat and please leave. And you think, well, they didn't even give him a shot. No, they didn't. And there's going to be living, walking, talking proof of his greatness right there before him. Because he's going to heal this demon. He's going to cast the demons out of this demonized guy. And really do everybody in that favor, in that region, a big favor. Because these guys used to hide in there in the tombs, and then any poor hapless traveler that wandered by, they'd jump out and mug them. So here you are being mugged by a naked guy. Man, it sounds like New York, doesn't it? I'm kidding, it's more like Jersey. No, okay. So 21, however, here, it is not likely that a Jew would be raising swine. It seems likely that this is one of the few times that Jesus entered Gentile territory and interacted with Gentiles. We also see that in Matthew 15, verses 21 through 28. And here we see he withdrew into the district of Tyre and Sidon, which was much more predominantly populated by Gentiles than even it was by Jews during that time up in Phoenicia, or what had been called Phoenicia. Way to the north there in Israel on the shores of the Mediterranean. And a Canaanite woman from the region, this is a Gentile, comes to it, and began to cry out, saying, "Have mercy on me, Lord, Son of David." Well, this must have been a pretty astute Gentile because she recognized the messianic title and how to use it. So what this leads me to believe she was a believer, that she had heard about Jesus and had come to believe in him and recognized him as the Messiah. "Have mercy on me, Lord, Son of David. My daughter is cruelly demon-possessed. Is there any other way?" You would think not. But he did not answer her a word. He ignores her. So he keeps on walking. She's behind him, you know, carrying on. And she's hollering at him, and he's just ignoring her, just walking on her. Just ignoring her. And she keeps hollering, and he didn't answer her a word. And his disciples came and implored him, saying, "Send her away, because she keeps shouting us. She's calling us names and hollering, and we don't like that, Jesus." Whining again? A little bit, probably. "Send her away, she's bugging us." And he answered and said, "I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel." And she came and began to bow down before him, saying, "Lord, help me." And he answered and said, "It is not good to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs." And she said, "That's true. Got me. But even the dogs feed at the crumbs which fall from their master's table." And Jesus said to her, "O woman, your faith is great. It shall be done for you as you wish." And her daughter was healed at once. And that's the only other, as we know, as far as we know, the only other interaction with Gentiles at that time, other than Herod himself. He does appear before Herod. But it's not much of an interaction because Jesus does the same thing. He just stands there and looks at him and never even speaks a word to him. And this woman, of course, even though she was a Gentile, she manifests great faith in the fact that Jesus could and would help her. And her argument there that, look, hey, the dogs get the scraps that fall off the table, come on. And then the whole big deal in the scheme of things, essentially what he's saying is, you're a Gentile dog, which is the way Jews tended to refer and deal with Gentiles. And it was very insulting. And yet she never misses a beat. She just says, okay, well, I may be a dog, but even if I am a dog, I should get the scraps. Give me your dog a little scratch. Let me be your dog. And Jesus said, okay, good. Yeah, well, all right, faith. And he responds to her faith. But she manifests great faith in him. So this was the only other time. Well, Mark and Luke record the fact that there was only one man that came out to meet Jesus. Matthew records the fact that he was met by two men. Matthew 8:28, and there is no textual issue here. The text is not suspect at this point in Matthew. So when he came to the other side, into the country of the Gadarenes, two men who were demon-possessed met him as they were coming out of the tombs. And they were so extremely violent that no one could pass by that way. And if you did, again, if you were hapless and unfortunate enough to pass by that way, they would rob you and beat you and tear you limb from limb if they could, unless you managed to escape them. But they had supernatural strength, so likely when they got a hold of you, you didn't have a lot of chance. As we're going to see, they were exceedingly strong. 23, although one can offer a number of explanations as to why there was a discrepancy, it seems wisest to conclude that Mark and Luke focus on a single man since his situation was the most notable. He clearly, as it turns out, is the leader of the two. That even in a group like that, a small group of two or three, you're going to have kind of a recognized alpha, you know, male. The dominant dog, as it were. And so this guy is, and secondarily, it appears that of the two, only he actually exercised faith in the Lord after the fact. The other guy's just not mentioned at all, and in a sense becomes inconsequential. Why? Well, because I think he got delivered just as the other guy did, as we're going to see, but he didn't ever respond. So most likely he ended up being demon possessed again, as we're going to see. It appears that he gets delivered as well, although we're not told explicitly that he gets delivered, but it would make sense that Jesus delivered them both. And here, once again, you see that it's not based on, and that people want to do this. Jesus does make a turn in his ministry, and he's kind of getting to that point, but he's not necessarily really there yet. But he's going to start making the faith of individuals more of an issue than he does in the past. One of the things we see in the earlier part of Mark is that this was all indiscriminate. There appears to be no, if anybody came and they wanted to be healed, he healed them. If anybody came and they wanted to be delivered from demons, he delivered them. He didn't stop them and interview them and ask them what their theology was, or did you believe on me, or any of this. He just intervenes. But then as the ministry goes on, he begins to make faith more and more and more of an issue. And he begins to make their lack of understanding more and more and more of an issue. And so this is one of the things with we call it the principle of culpability. And that is, the longer Jesus is present on the planet with these people, the longer, the more and more and more his teaching piles up and they become responsible for it. And then if they reject it, well, guess what? They lose out. 24, the first portion of verse 2 is a genitive absolute clause, which provides circumstantial information, but is not grammatically connected with the sentence that follows. And that's the way you set it apart, is with this genitive absolute setup in the Greek. Here, 25, in other words, while we are told that Jesus disembarked from the boat he was in, the emphasis is on the man with the demons coming to meet him. That's the real emphasis of the sentence. The fact that he got out of the boat, well, sure, we would expect that. But, I mean, Mark records it, but we naturally would expect that everybody got out of the boat. Not just Jesus, but everybody did. In fact, if he was in the back of the boat, he would have likely gotten out last. I mean, depending on where he was and all that. Unless they all said, well, Jesus said, I'm going out first, you guys stay here. We're not told that, so it would seem from given what we know that he would have probably climbed out last or close to last. In other words, we're told the emphasis is on the man with the demons. 26, as soon as Jesus leaves the boat, he is encountered by a man with an unclean spirit who had come out from among the tombs. And 27, Hellenistic thought and Jewish thought were not far apart when it came to some views on demons. Both believed them to be spirits that dwelled in lonely places or around tombs. 28, Jewish belief seems to have placed the demon-possessed individual in uninhabited places by day and in or around the tombs by night. that they would, you know, they were allowed, they were free to, as it were, travel around, of course. And so they had them in desert or waste places during the day, and then at night they would go to the tombs to sleep. 29, therefore, the scene is an eerie one. As the still anxious disciples and Jesus are confronted by an apparent madman immediately upon arrival, either just before or just after dark. Again, it's hard to say precisely where we are in terms of light here, but it doesn't seem, there's nothing in the text that indicates to me anybody had a hard time seeing all this. It seems to me that it was fairly obvious what was going on. And 30, add to this the fact that all those that have arrived on the shore were probably physically and emotionally exhausted, and likely still somewhat fearful. As well, likely, I think that's an understatement, but I threw it in there. I can use understatement as well, see? So 31, the Greek verb hupantao, met or encountered, can be used of friendly encounters and hostile opposition. In this case, the second meaning is in view. Luke 14:31, when they come running out, it's clearly not going to be pleasant. It's not designed to be pleasant. No doubt they intend to overpower everybody there and do whatever they choose to do. That's their shtick. And there's no reason to think they were going to change it. Here it shows you that it can be used in a hostile sense. Or what king, when he sets out to meet another in battle? There the word meet is clearly not used in a friendly sense. I mean, they're going out to fight each other. Will not first sit down and consider whether he is strong enough with 10,000 men to encounter the one coming against him with 20,000 men. Well, if you're outnumbered, that is going to make it tough. But the great military leaders of history never found that to be a problem, a.k.a., for instance, Alexander the Great. He was outnumbered on many occasions, and he still managed to win every battle, just about. So that obviously doesn't always determine the winner. Well, 32, Luke indicates that this man had been in this demon-possessed condition for a long time, manifesting his torment by wearing no clothing and living in the graveyard. Matthew notes that the two men were both violent and would allow no one to pass by. We have looked at the Matthew account there, but Luke 8:27, Luke tells us, and I think Luke, being a physician, he tends to think a different way than these other guys do. Obviously, he's Gentile to boot, where it appears that all the other authors are Jewish. I think Luke took a little bit more fascination in some of these events and some of these healings and all of that, because as being a doctor, this was, you know, important to him. So Luke 8:27, and when he came out onto the land, he was met by a man from the city who was possessed with demons and who had not had put on any clothing for a long time and was not living in a house but in the tombs. And we find that in Mark, if you look ahead into our next verse, actually, he had his dwelling among the tombs. And each one of these accounts tells us an individual, you know, we get these individual little details that we can put together the whole picture. They are strong, they attack people, they generally live in the tombs, and they have been apparently bound and tried to be subdued because they're a threat, obviously, out there. They're such a threat that they tried to subdue them with chains, and these guys had developed and manifested supernatural strength to where you couldn't bind them or tie them down anymore. So essentially, they couldn't be stopped. This is what Jesus walks into. Two demon-possessed men that everybody essentially has given up on and said, you know, these guys can't be handled, we just stay away from them. You know, there may have been warning signs out there, avoid the tombs. A naked madman on the loose, you know, enter at your own risk, kind of deal. I mean, we're not really told, but it seems everybody knew this. This was common knowledge in that area. So when, as we're going to see at the end of this all, jumping ahead a little bit, when Jesus heals this guy and casts out the demons, everybody knows what a dramatic change has occurred. They can't argue with it. They know this guy. And again, perhaps his family still lived in the area. I mean, we're not really told. But he had to come from somewhere in that region, we would think. And so 33, it would appear that these men came out to confront Jesus as a matter of course. In other words, they didn't just pick on Jesus because they say, oh, this is Jesus. I mean, I think they would have come out against anybody that showed up there that night, towards evening. That was their deal. So the noise of the boats coming ashore, perhaps hearing the noise of the boats coming ashore, and then the demons recognized who he was. But there's no indication that the man himself knows. And this gets into one of the things we'll have to consider and we'll look at. Our time's gone today, but the interaction between the consciousness of a demonized individual, what they actually know, and how much the demon affects their actual conscious perception of things. And one of the things that becomes pretty clear is that once they know who Jesus is, the demons take the lead in this conversation. Now, obviously, they're speaking through the voice box of this guy. Just as one could articulate doctrine for God, one can articulate all kinds of stuff for the devil. I mean, depending upon, again, the level of demonization. We call it here, and I didn't change all this, because the reality is... But the deal is, the Greek is all demonized, not, quote, demon-possessed, per se. But that's the language that's been used, so again, I'm not going to change all that. But the fact becomes evident that there are levels of this, and not all of them are equally as bad. In this case, we're going to find out that this guy has a legion of demons within him, not just a small number. This isn't just an individual with one demon. This is an individual that may have had 1,000 demons or more living in him. How weird would he get? Well, I think the naked living in the tomb things gives you, you know, a view, a little bit, of how weird it would get. But, you know, as people succumb to demonic thinking, expect to see their behavior and their attitudes and all that deteriorate in a commensurate fashion. Okay, well, our time's gone, so we will stop there and be ready to move on with the next verse on Tuesday. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for the opportunity to fellowship with Positive Volition in the things of your word. We pray that you would sanctify this information to our souls. In Christ's name, amen.